Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Tonight I've been asked to give a particular talk, and this is a talk on the first death anniversary of someone's dear brother. And the circumstances of his death is the starting point for the theme of this talk, because this person was a very well-known doctor, an oncologist. Those of you who haven't had any experience with doctors and oncologists may not know that they're specialists in treating cancer. And this person was not only very well known because he was a good doctor, but because he was a very kind and compassionate, very gentle and soft doctor who really looked after his patients well. And he was only in his early 50s, and he was at the airport about to fly out to address an international conference, and he suddenly felt unwell, and before he could leave the departure lounge, he died. So his death left a lot of people asking lots of questions. First of all, they were very surprised, particularly his patients, because many of his patients, of course, assumed that he was going to outlive them. When they went to see him, they were expecting that he was going to treat them and they would die long before the doctor. So it came as a shock to everyone, but particularly to the patients, that the doctor had passed away first. And so this is something for you to keep in mind next time you go to see the doctor and you're feeling sick and you're feeling miserable, that you don't know which of you is going to pass away first. And so it's very nice if your offering to the doctor can not only be that you pay the bill, but you also wish the doctor well. And so in this situation, what happened was that many patients continued to contact the doctor's surgery, unaware that he'd passed away, wanting to tell him how they were going with their treatment and to thank him for his kindness and his care. And so even a year later, people are still contacting him, or his contacting his surgery or his family, to be in touch and also to express their sorrow to hear what happened. And this was the other point, that it wasn't just that he was a very skillful doctor, but he was very kind and compassionate. And this is what people keep on saying, because when you're being treated by an oncologist, you hope, of course, that they're going to make you better, but you know very often that that's not going to be the result. But to have a doctor who's very kind and caring, who really puts a lot of time and effort into looking after you as an individual, that's something special that actually helps with the treatment. It's a very important part of the healing process that goes on. And that's what people remarked on when they talked about this doctor and when they contacted family to talk about him. So the circumstances of his death made people sit up and think, wow, fancy that could happen. What would it be like if I was on my own, say at the airport, no one knows who I am, and all of a sudden I just have a few minutes left to live? And the question comes up, what would I be taking with me when I go? Because no matter how famous I've become, no matter what I've accumulated in terms of worldly possessions, no matter who I have as my family or friends, who is going to be there? And not only who is going to be there, in this case no one was there, but what am I going to be able to take with me when I go? Because there's no one there at that time to even remind me or to recognize this is what's happening, this very good person is about to leave us. And so the real theme of the talk is, what do we have left when everything else is taken away? And how do we really get it through our head that we too one day will die? And if we do get it through our head, how will that affect the way that we live our life? So the theme of the talk is creating inner wealth. And this is very topical, not only because it's triggered by someone's death, but because this society is so caught up in trying to create material wealth, material prosperity, and people are literally running themselves ragged, running themselves into tremendous debt, running themselves into lots of interpersonal conflict within families, within businesses, trying to create outer wealth and outer prosperity. But the example of this doctor is very powerful to show that in the end, when it's your time, you can't take any of that with you. And all you can take with you, you yourself, forgetting about the people who are going to talk about you afterwards or miss you afterwards, you yourself can only take what you've got in your heart. And what you've got in your heart is what you've accumulated through how you've lived your life. And this is the inner wealth, which we, in Buddhism, put much more emphasis on. How we die is very crucial for how we're going to be reborn. So it's not only how we die is affected by how we live this life, but how we live this life will affect how we die and where we are reborn. And even if you don't believe that we're going to be reborn anywhere else, just think about how you'll face that final moment all on your own, somewhere without anything to show except what's in your heart. Now, when I was asked to talk about this topic tonight, I was reflecting on how to approach it, and fortuitously I was in the middle of reading a book which has a very profound message about this very topic. And it's a book that's called Man's Search for Meaning, written by a person, Viktor Frankl. It's a very famous book that's often quoted as being one of the most influential spiritual books that's appeared in the last 50 years. Viktor Frankl was a psychiatrist who practiced in Vienna before the Second World War, and because of his Jewishness, his Jewish background, he was a prisoner in a concentration camp, in four concentration camps, together with his family. And throughout the course of being in the concentration camps, his mother and his father and his brother and his pregnant wife all died. And this book, Man's Search for Meaning, was his way of trying to come to terms with not just what happened to them, but how they dealt with what happened to them, and particularly what he was able to glean from that so that he could go on with the rest of his life. Because he was a psychiatrist, he was already very interested in the mind, and he was an experiential psychiatrist, someone who was very focused on what it was like for him and how he was doing it and what the impact was like, so that he could not just talk in theories about other people but how it felt from his side. And in his description of what happened to people as they were taken to the concentration camp, we have a very wonderful and powerful analogy to what is happening to us at this very moment as we undertake the journey through life from birth to death. He describes how people were aware that their life was in danger before they were rounded up to go to the concentration camps, and that some people sought to escape, but some people felt that they couldn't run away because they had family obligations. So he had his elderly parents to think about, even though he had a visa to go to America, and so he decided to stay. This was in Vienna. And eventually they were taken into custody, and they were crowded onto trains, and they were crowded to the extent that they could barely have room to stand, let alone to sit or lie down in the compartments. There were no toilets, just a bucket, but you couldn't get to the bucket. And they were in these crowded trains for many days with no food on their way to the camp. Because no one came back from the camp, they really didn't know what it was like, but they imagined what it was like. But still, they hoped that it wouldn't be as bad as they thought. And so even as they were crowded in the train carriages and experiencing these extremely terrible conditions, amongst themselves, there was still this hope that it wasn't really going to be as bad as they anticipated, that somehow it wasn't really going to be like that. It wasn't really going to happen. And as they journeyed towards the camp, with that sense of hoping that it's not really going to be that bad, or that it's somehow we're going to be the ones who miss out, isn't this like all of us who journey on through life, knowing that the end of this life is definitely going to come someday, not knowing when it's going to happen or how it's going to happen, but secretly thinking, maybe not to me, or maybe it's not going to happen and then we have all of these ideas about how we can adjust it and make it not too difficult, not too harsh, not too bad. This sense of hope that somehow we're going to miss out on arriving at the end of this journey. And then the people on the journey, even though they had been herded together and taken away from their homes, everyone was carrying something that connected them with their previous life, their home life. So some people had a little suitcase, some people had a little package, those things that they thought were going to be useful, those things that might just help to make it not so uncomfortable. And some people had things that they thought would remind them of what they had before, little keepsakes. Some of them had things that they'd been given, something that their mother had made for them, or something they'd received on their 15th birthday, a special occasion, or something like that. And they were all carrying these things. And, of course, they were in their family groups. And so when they arrived at the camp, those of you who have some background knowledge of what happened, very often people were selected immediately whether they were going to live or whether they were going to die. And, of course, they didn't really fully grasp that this was what was happening as they were lined up and they were paraded by an officer, before an officer who with the raising of his hand pointed either to the right or the left. Those that went to the left were going to survive. Those who went to the right were doomed to be killed within a few hours. The ones who were kept alive were the ones who could work, the ones who were strong enough to do something to contribute to the war effort. The ones that looked as though they were too weak, too sick, too many encumbrances, might be difficult, they were immediately sent off to the gas chamber. And people at that time, when they were lined up, of course, looked for their family members. Oh, I'm together with my family, I'm with my parents, or I'm with my children, or I'm with people I know, hoping that that would somehow provide some sort of safety, some sort of comfort, and of course some recognition. Oh, well, we're a group, we're together. I'm sure they won't separate families. And of course, no heed was taken of whether one was in a family group or not. And again, isn't this like us when we build up our relationships with each other and we hope somehow that those relationships will protect us, that they'll be with us, they'll be there for us when we need it most. And the example of the person that I mentioned at the beginning who was on his own about to take off from the airport, all those relatives who loved him dearly, who would have been there if they'd known, would have been there if they could, no one was there. He was there completely on his own. And so as these prisoners faced the person who was making the decision, family grouping was no security. People were separated and people were sent according to other criteria. And then he describes how people were still clutching their little bags, their little packets, the things that were really important to them. And when they were told to throw them all down, people started to bargain. Can't I just keep this wedding ring? This is really important to me. Can't I just keep this lucky charm? This is something that I always keep with me. It's just a tiny thing. And there was no allowance for personal keepsakes, personal things. Nothing counted. Everything had to be thrown away. And again, we can see ourselves in this bargaining of, this might look after me, my lucky charm that I wear around my neck. These are things that I've been associated with for so many years that identify with me with who I am, connect me to the things that are important to me, or you show that I've been a Buddhist all these years. You can tell by the fact that I'm wearing this or that. Or if you're a monk or nun, I've got my head shaven. But these outer symbols, these other things that are seem so close to us, so personal, these also need to be given up at the time of death. Now, it's very interesting. I often notice when we go on meditation retreats and people take 8 precepts, and one of those precepts is not to wear any jewellery during the time of the meditation retreat. And people are just so used to wearing earrings or wearing their wedding ring or wearing other studs in other places that they just don't think to take those things off, that they're additions, adornments. They're just me. You can't mean the wedding ring. I mean, that's not an addition. That's something that, I never take that off. And you can see how hard it is to get through the mind that at the time of death, everything has to go. And so these people were forced to relinquish even the most personal items. And then the thing that happened next was that they were all forced to take off every piece of clothing. And sometimes when people were coming to the camp, they were thinking, oh, I hope they won't make us undress in front of other people, or I hope they'll give us separate places where we can get changed. None of that. Just people had to just strip. And you couldn't keep even the clothes on your back. And the next thing that happened was that all those who survived this first part of the selection were then taken away and had all their body hair removed, completely shaven, so they were left completely naked, completely bare. And in his description of this, Viktor Frankl says how at each stage people became more and more incredulous that they were being stripped of everything. 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 And it wasn't until they'd reached the final point where they had no clothing and then were shaven that they thought they had come to the end of having things taken away. But then what happened was that their complete identity was taken away. Anything that said who they were from their past life, any reference to their professional status, any papers which showed what they had accomplished in their life before this was also taken away. Even their name was taken away and they were all given a number. From now on, the person that they were no longer existed. They were only this number. And he said it was very interesting to see how, for some people, that was in a way liberating, because some people actually took on a new identity. It suited them to leave behind a life which they hadn't enjoyed. But for those who had been successful, those who had something behind them, who'd built up a life, it was absolutely devastating. Even more devastating to some than having to give up their clothing, being shaven, the fact that they were no longer recognized as who they were. And just as an aside, one of the scenes he quotes from a play that was written to describe what it was like for people in this situation. In that play, there's a scene where someone comes up to one of the SS officers carrying with him all his worldly credentials. He's got letters of reference from important people. He's got his degrees from the university and his signs that say to what professional associations he belongs, and one by one he hands them to the SS officer, and the SS officer looks at them, and he finally, when the fellow's handed them all to him, he says, "Is that all you've got?" And the man says, "Yes," because always in the past those things have been very impressive. And then the officer's saying, "Is that all you've got?" The fellow says, "Yes." And he throws them then in the bin, the garbage bin, and he says, and the officer says, "Good, now you've got nothing." The devastation of that for someone whose life has been defined by the respect of others. And we can ask ourselves, how would we stand up in those circumstances? Because this is what happens at the time of death. No one knows what we've done, who we are. We can be completely alone in a completely alien situation without anyone to substantiate, gee, this is a good person, this is a great person, this is a wonderful person. The only one who's going to be there who knows is we ourselves. And as Viktor Frankl goes on to describe life in the concentration camps, from the perspective of a prisoner, he doesn't at any time set himself apart from the people who are going through this experience. There is no sense in which he says, that I was better than them because I could do all of these things. He recognizes, makes a very poignant statement, a very powerful statement, that the best of us did not return. Because in order to survive in those situations, people were really pushed to the limit. And the theory was that when you take away everything from people and just make survival the most important thing, that you will bring everyone to the same level. That there'll be no difference between the people who were well educated, the people who were wealthy, the people who were refined, the people who had some standing. There'll be no difference between those people, the spiritual people, the good people, and the people who hadn't developed those qualities. When it comes down to it and people are just interested in getting enough to eat, finding some place that's warm or dry, not being singled out for work that they know is going to kill them, when it comes down to that, you won't find any differences. People will all be the same. What Viktor Frankl describes in his book is that that wasn't the case. Even though everyone in that situation was subject to hunger, cold, the fear that at any moment their life could be taken, there actually was a difference between people. Only the minority of people, he points out, were able to maintain a sense of human dignity, a sense of their own worth, in those crushing conditions. Many people did succumb to survival, self-preservation. And one of the things he said that helped people to survive was to find some identity in that camp situation. So though their past life and credentials had been taken away from them, those who were able to get a position in the hierarchy, take on some job in the camp, regained some sense of themselves as having worth, being all right, some sense of security. And he said it was very interesting to see that the people who didn't have any status, any job, any recognition, who were actually defined by the system again and again as not being worth anything, having no value, that most of those people ended up believing it and acting only to stay alive. But he said there was a minority of people who were able to rise above that and to actually live a life of goodness even in those most dreadful conditions. People who were able to practice generosity when generosity meant just sharing the last piece of bread that you had. Giving a kind word to someone who was just about to give up when you yourself were also wretchedly tired and very, very sick. When you were experiencing the same sorts of terrible conditions. He said there were enough people, and he witnessed it often enough, to see that even in the most dreadful circumstances, it was possible for people to choose not to succumb to the lowest common denominator, to make self-preservation the most important thing. And those people who were able to resist that were the people who were able to maintain their dignity. Now, it didn't mean that they were the people who survived, who lived, because very often the fact that they were kind and generous, that they refused to do things which were ruthless, which were harmful, which involved lying or cheating or stealing or whatever else people had to do to stay alive, meant that they were often the first to die. Or that even if they survived for some time, they eventually died. So they actually sacrificed themselves very often. So it wasn't that their goodness was a way of surviving. In fact, it often led to the opposite. But when they died with their dignity and their self-respect intact. And so he, through his observation and through having been in that situation, he makes a analysis of what those people had that made it possible for them to do what they did and to die in the way they did. And he points to their inner life, their inner wealth, the things which they had developed and accumulated, sometimes well in advance of facing such a drastic situation, the way they'd lived their lives, the way they'd cultivated their minds, so that when they got into those situations, they had that inner strength, that reservoir of goodness, of kindness developed, which they could call on. At the very least, they had this sense of not being willing to succumb to becoming more and more like an animal and being driven by the base instincts for survival. Now, some people were able to develop this before they came into those drastic conditions through circumstances, through having people that they loved, that they wanted to protect, that they wanted to stay alive to help that person, but to help them in a way where it was not just for their own preservation. But mostly it was the people who had already done a lot of inner work before they got into that situation. And so he talks about the kind of inner work that he could see that people had done. He talks a lot about the cultivation of the intellect, the refinement of the intellect, but also the cultivation of the heart in terms of goodness, kindness, generosity, non-material qualities which one can't carry with one and which one can't put on display. Now, these are the very qualities that Buddhist practice is about. Because although we live in the world, and we live in a world in which we have to act, the basis of our understanding of how we do that most skillfully is that we cultivate the inner world, our inner life, and then we act on that and express it in our outer actions. So it's not that we are just focusing on the inner world for the inner world's sake only. It also has an instrumental purpose, and that is so that as we act in the world, we act with more goodness, more kindness, more compassion, more wisdom, through understanding where it all starts. It all starts from inside us, not from the outer conditions of our life. And this is really the crux of what Viktor Frankl discovered for himself, and which he took to be the main linchpin of his work as a psychiatrist from then on, was the realization that it's not what happens to us in our life that's really important, it's what we do with what happens to us in our life. Now, this is something that we might have heard many times in contemporary psychology, New Age thinking. But when he wrote about this, and he wrote about it from his deep personal experience back in 1945, it was a revolutionary concept. And here was someone speaking from having lived through the very worst that one could experience, and seeing that even in those most difficult circumstances, it was not what happened to people, but what they did with what happened to them that made the difference in whether they were able to maintain their human dignity, their sense of worth, their connection with others in a compassionate and loving way. And this stems from the inner wealth that one has. And as I said at the beginning, the title of this talk is Developing Inner Wealth. Because when we come down to the moment of our death, hopefully none of us will ever face the situation of being incarcerated in a concentration camp where everything is stripped away from us, where we lose everything that we take to be dear. Even if we avoid that, we will still face that moment in this life where we have to let go of everything that we've accumulated, whether it's relationships, whether it's non-material things like our status and our reputation. Ultimately, everything has to go. And yet you can hear in our deepest part of our heart, we have that resistance, just like the people on the train, that maybe it won't be like that. Maybe there's something that we can still take with us or hang on to, or somehow we can delay it or negotiate it so that it won't be as bad as it could be. And there's something that we're still trying to hold on to, still trying to take with us to make it bearable. The only thing we can take is what is in our heart at the time of our death. So one of the biggest helps for us is to realize that our death is going to come one day and not to fight it when it's happening. Now it's interesting to contemplate whether anyone who's a health professional and sees people sick and dying day after day actually ever contemplates that one day that will be me. Or anyone who works, for example, in the funeral industry ever contemplates that one day it will be me that's in the coffin or that's going into the cremation. But all of us are surrounded again and again by reminders of how things come and go and how our life is not forever. And particularly if we have faith in the Buddha's teaching, we're reminded that this isn't the only life that we've lived, and that after this life we're going to be reborn somewhere else. So where do we want to go? What sort of life are we heading towards for our next birth? We create the conditions for that by how we live this life. And recently at the monastery, when it was New Year, I was encouraging people to recognize that it's not really a new year, it's a recycled year. Because we don't finish with last year and all the things that we were doing and all the things that were occupying us and preoccupying us and worrying us when it comes to the 31st of December. 1st of January, brand new start. Not like that at all. We recycle last year into this year. And when we contemplate in that way, we think, well, what do I want to recycle into this year? We look back over the last year and say, what can I learn from it? The things that went right, the things that went wrong. What can I rejoice in? And what can I say, I don't want that to happen again? Actually, we have it in our power to start to create the sort of life we want. And if we recognize it's not only recycling from last year to this year, but from this life to next life, and from last life to this life, from this life to next life, then we realize how much power we have. But we just have to be willing to take it up, to use it, to do something with it. And the message is, even in the worst circumstances, we can still do something useful with it. And to create the ability to do that, we start right where we are. So when we're sitting here and it's hot, we work with coming to terms and accepting heat. And we watch whether or not we can come to terms with and accept heat. How do we bargain? Oh, I wish they'd close that door. I wish they'd put the fans on earlier. Next time I'm going to get here early and I'm going to sit right under the fan. we bargain with it. We try to negotiate it. We try to change the conditions. And if we keep on doing that moment after moment, episode after episode, this day, tomorrow, throughout this year, into next year, we end up at the moment of our death trying to bargain our way out of it. So we're actually changing very fundamental habit patterns with these very simple practices. This very simple practice of meditation where we allow the conditions around us to be as they are. The heat, the touch, the sounds, the way the body feels, what we've got to do tomorrow, what happened to us today. Those things we can just let them be. And then we come into the present moment as it is. We relax into the present moment. And we find a place of peace and stillness through holding the mind, resting the mind on one object, the breath, as it goes in and out. Nothing fantastic, nothing amazing, but the results are fantastic. The results are amazing if we can just practice this again and again. We start to be able to be at peace in the midst of turmoil. Not peace out there, but peace inside. And from that space of peace, then we can engage in a peaceful way with the world. Now, at the situation of being in a concentration camp or in that sort of kind of situation, the basic question we all ask ourselves is, what's most important? Is survival at any cost the most important thing? And for some people that will be, survival is all I've got. But if we have a rich inner life, a life of love, a life of compassion, a life of goodness, then there is a sense of having something even when we have nothing. Of having something that's so precious that we wouldn't want to jeopardize that, give it away, tarnish it for anything, not even for the sake of life. Now, this is completely contrary to what most people are brought up to think, that life at any cost is what we have to preserve. But for someone who's cultivating this path, we can see that there comes a time when we say life at any cost is not the most important thing, because we know that how we die in this life is going to create the conditions for how we're going to be born in the next life. And that becomes even more important because we want to continue this journey in a way that helps us to grow in wisdom and to grow in compassion. And at the heart of our delusion is this self-cherishing idea of me, mine, most important centre of the universe. And that's what we act on in the way that we engage in the world very often. Because until we grow this inner wealth, we don't have much else to fall back on. We only have the things of this world to find refuge in, to seek security with. But when we cultivate this spiritual life, the spiritual path, we actually discover tremendous riches that are valuable above everything else. The peace of mind, the sense of ease, the sense of belonging, no matter what anyone else says, no matter how anyone else defines us, those are all things that we can realize through this practice. Central to that is realizing that we're actually nothing special, that we're just part of this whole phenomenon of existence. And we find our place in that whole thing without needing to be special and without needing to be in a particular situation or incarnation on the outside. But on the inside, we want to be able to continue to develop that understanding, that wisdom, that feeling of being part of this whole thing, of not having to be anything special, of having something that doesn't depend on outer conditions. And that's why in the circumstances where we're really faced with survival at any cost, survival isn't that important, isn't as important as maintaining the treasure that we have in our heart. Now, just as the simple practice of meditation that we've done tonight starts us, helps us to develop the ability to come to peace, to find peace and to come to terms with conditions as they are at this moment in our life, so all of the seemingly simple things like keeping precepts, living a virtuous life, refraining from doing what is harmful, harmful to ourselves, harmful to others, actively cultivating goodness, generosity, truthfulness, reliability, contentment, all of those things, those simple basic practices are the ones that provide the nucleus for developing and accumulating this inner wealth. And the more we practice it in the easy times, in the easy situations, the more we'll be able to call on it when we get into the really testing, trying times, long before we face our death, just trying to live this life as well as we can as a good human being. And as we continue to cultivate these qualities, as we develop our meditation, the mind finds a place of peace, a place of love that it can abide in, a place of stillness, a place of clarity where it can start to see things not so much from an egocentric perspective, but from a universal perspective. And as we discover that, as we start to live it out, it's such a freeing experience to not be so dependent on material things, on social definitions of who we are, whether or not we're successful or good, whatever it is that we depend on. And this is where we find true freedom, true peace, true happiness. And this is even before we've become enlightened. The people in the concentration camp who were able to demonstrate the power of human goodness were not enlightened beings. They didn't even know about the Buddha's teaching. But they were willing to sacrifice all they had at that time to serve others, but also to safeguard their inner wealth, those truly valuable, wonderful qualities of love, compassion, care and concern for others, integrity, all of those non-material assets. So to cultivate that wealth, we don't have to look far, we just have to be very patient and persevering in cultivating the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. The whole of what we need to do is there in that path. The guidelines are very clearly set out. It's very straightforward. We shouldn't underestimate the path, thinking that it's too simple, too obvious. As we cultivate it, we find that what seems simple and obvious is not actually very easy to do. It really takes a lot of perseverance, practice over time, but we will get the results and we will find that the path deepens. Rather than thinking that we've got to add more to it, we just have to go deeper in our cultivation, in our understanding of what the Noble Eightfold Path involves. So we don't know when the time of our death will come. We don't know in what circumstances. We only know that one day for sure it will happen. And when we come to that moment, we don't want to be like that person where everything that we've taken our life to cultivate is thrown in the garbage bin and we're told, well, good, now you've got nothing left. What do we have left when we've got nothing left? That's the question I like to leave with you for your own contemplation and reflection. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of you, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādemi. Svakato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka-sangho sanghaṃ namāmi.